Today's guest is someone who's completely changing the way we think about ADHD, executive functioning, and what kids actually need to succeed in the real world. Joining us is Michael McLeod, founder of Grow Now ADHD, creator of the internal skills coaching model, and an award-winning speaker who spent over 20 years helping kids, teens, and families navigate ADHD and executive function challenges. He's also the author of the Executive Function Playbook, Building Independence in Kids with ADHD, along with the Executive Function Playbook in Action Workbook, and co-host of the ADHD Parenting Podcast. Through his work, Mike focuses on something different: building the internal skills kids actually need to function, self-regulate, motivate, create awareness, and independence. His message is simple but powerful. Most kids with ADHD don't lack intelligence. They lack an internal GPS. And that's exactly what he helps build. If you're a coach, parent, or educator working with neurodivergent athletes or kids who feel stuck, misunderstood, or constantly behind, this conversation is going to challenge how you think and give you real practical tools you can actually use. So let's get into it. Hey, Mike, thanks for joining.
Thanks so much for having me. This is really exciting. I definitely love what you guys are doing. This is really incredible. It's such a really important message that you guys are sharing. This is not your typical, you know, podcast that's very, you know, generalized. This is something that's really quite needed. So you guys are doing some great work.
No, thank you very much. And to our audience, this is also our first episode where my wife, Aleka, is joining us too, because we're so interested and have done so much research for this. And we've looked at all your work, and we're super excited to have this conversation. So welcome, Aleka, as well.
Yeah, I definitely wanted to join in on this podcast because I have a lot of questions to ask myself.
So this is the first one. This is the first one you're joining?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Wow. I didn't know that. I was not aware. Okay. All right.
So
now I'm nervous.
I am curious, Mike, you know, really to kind of take a step back, you know, what in your life made you say, okay, this is the direction in my career that I'm going to go?
That's a fantastic question. So growing up, I always wanted to be a teacher. I was a young kid that always thought about becoming a dad someday, always wanted to be a teacher. My mom was an incredible teacher for many, many decades. She went to the same high school she went to as a student and then became the chair of the math department and was a very successful teacher. So it was just in my blood, in my DNA to be a teacher. I ended up going to get my bachelor's degree, and I started as School of Education, and my mentor, my main person there, convinced me to switch out of education to law. And because he was like, you know, the field of education is changing so much, you're probably not going to want to become a teacher. And then I ended up doing an externship in law and absolutely hated it. I couldn't stand it. It was just, you know, too many meticulous reading and notes and nonsense. So I ended up kind of going back to my roots, and I started working at a children's center in New York, which was a residential treatment facility for kids with such severe needs. They had to live full time on campus in one of the cottages, go to school on the campus as well. And from there, I ended up becoming a one-to-one with one of the students, and he received speech and language therapy. And I was able to see firsthand and observe these sessions where he was able to work with someone one-to-one in an area that directly improved quality of life. So it wasn't just teaching math, science, social studies, these things that we see AI doing for kids now anyway. So I was able to work on direct skills and improve their overall quality of life. So I instantly went back and got my second bachelor's in speech and then got my master's degree in speech and language pathology. And then from there, I ended up working with a national nonprofit through my supervisor, who was a speech specialist, with a group of boys and girls with chromosomal disorders that all had ADHD. And I'm someone who grew up with ADHD myself, so I was very emotionally magnetized towards that. And I learned very quickly there's little out there for these kids. There's not, you know, they're spending thousands of dollars, thousands of hours on therapy and counseling and all these approaches that, number one, you find out really aren't even evidence-based, and it's not improving their long-term outcomes. They're wasting money. They're wasting time. They're graduating high school. The IEP is going away. The 504 is going away, and they're stuck. So I, you know, took a deep dive into Dr. Russell Barkley, Sarah Ward, Dr. George McCloskey, developed the internal skills treatment model. We did a year-long research study on it at a school here in Newtown Square, and everything's really expanded from there.
That's awesome.
I was a math teacher, and I was there for 10 years, and I left because education industry did change a bit. So I'm not saying that the mentor was wrong with, but I obviously had a lot of children in my classroom with ADHD and their 504s and IEP plans. So that's why also I'm very invested in this with our son and all of that. So with that said, I think, like you said, there's not a lot that information out there around everything that has to do with ADHD. I think initially when somebody thinks of, oh, my son has ADHD, they think, oh, he's very hyperactive and inattentive. Correct. And that's it. But there's so many more things that fall under that umbrella. And I think that's what I want to ask you about. And me and Derek were talking, something that is related to ADHD that you can elaborate on is our son struggles a lot with the social awareness piece and how he comes across to other people, especially teachers and maybe new coaches that don't know him as well. And he's not trying to be rude or disrespectful, but it may come across that way to somebody that does not know him. And that's been a struggle for us. And I think you refer to it on your podcast as social perspective functioning.
Yeah.
So can you explain what that is and why it's so hard for ADHD kids to socially kind of, you know, portray, you know, give off a good, you know, vibe and not,
of course,
respectful vibe. Yep.
Exactly. Yeah. So long story short, ADHD might be the most misunderstood and mislabeled diagnosis in all of psychiatry. ADHD is not an attention disorder. It's not about hyperactivity or inattentiveness. It is a disorder of the executive functioning system. If you have ADHD, you have executive functioning developmental disorder, not an attention deficit disorder. And executive functioning is not time management and organization and messy backpacks, messy folders. Mm-hmm. It's the ability to be overall self-aware, which is what you're referring to, mm-hmm. to the ability to self-regulate your emotions, your language, your body, your behavior, the ability to self-motivate towards non-preferred, non-instantly gratifying tasks, and then the ability to self-evaluate and learn from past experiences and not repeat mistakes. Those are all of those internal skills and that internal GPS that Derek mentioned earlier. And then there are three separate zones to executive functioning. Most people know about academic executive functioning, being a good student, getting your work done, following the rules, getting good grades. But actually, the area where we see the most ADHD executive dysfunctions symptoms is in the home. So the home is where it is unstructured and there's unconditional relationships. So no one sees more ADHD symptoms than the parents in the home behind closed doors. So self-regulation towards parents and siblings and the ability to do non-preferred tasks in the home. That's home executive functioning. Then really one of the most beautiful things to come out of this whole neurodiversity movement of the past 20 years is this whole concept of social executive functioning, not social skills. So there's external social skills, which is eye contact, topic maintenance, circles of communication, all things that help kids follow the rules of social dialogue, which really just ends up increasing their social anxiety and doesn't improve. Like all the parents listening to this right now, think about any kid who's gone through years and years and years of social skills groups and lunch bunches. Has that actually helped the kid make friends and keep friends on the weekends or the afternoons or the evenings? Isn't that the whole goal of putting kids in a social skills group? Because we're focusing on the wrong skills. It's too adult directed and it's not helping kids be kids. Really, we need to look at internal social executive functioning, which is number one, perspective taking skills and the ability to understand the thoughts and feelings you put in others' heads. So whether you're giving them sort of clutch, warm thoughts that makes them want to be around you and be associated with you, or you're giving them kind of cringy thoughts that makes them not want to be around you because you're making them feel uncomfortable. Then there's situational awareness, which is the ability to stand back and read the room, read the field before you enter a social environment. Very, very important for student athletes and young kids who are in athletics, kind of observing others and following others' leads. Then you have social reciprocity, 50-50 relationships, and then social relatedness. So there's a huge, huge aspect of social associated with ADHD that often gets misdiagnosed.
Yeah, I think that immediately you mentioned eye contact, and funny enough, my next question had to do with eye contact. First off, we did have the guidance counselor last year in our son's school practice some social work with him, you know, so, you know, with other kids. And I, like you said, I don't think it was very effective. Mm-hmm. He has gotten better over the years, like as we've, you know, worked with him and as he's matured, but he still struggles in a lot of those areas. And I think eye contact, and speaking loudly and clearly to other people is extremely hard. And I was wondering, you know, is that something that we parents should be pushing on an ADHD child? Like, make eye contact, speak up. Should we be saying those things? Or is that something that we should just say, hey, like, he's doing his best?
So eye contact you should not be working on, because eye contact is completely overblown and is talked about far too much. First of all, neurotypicals don't do eye contact very well. And second of all, it's also very culturally based. So it's not, you know, it's not a necessity for social success to look someone in the eye. This is not, you know, the military. Mm-hmm. This is informal, you know, informal social conversations between children. So eye contact is a total waste of time. If his vocal volume is too low and people can't hear him and understand him, that's more of, you know, that could be a self-awareness piece. He's not aware of how low he's speaking or how fast or how slow it is. That mm-hmm. could be more of a speech and language thing. There's a major correlation. I know my personal career, I went from speech and language pathology to ADHD, but there's a huge connection between kids with ADHD that need speech and language therapy when they're kids and may need it concurrently with the parent training and the executive functioning coaching. So if he's not speaking loudly enough or not clearly enough, we may need to teach him some vocal volume exercises. We may need to help him with the pace of his dialogue, whatever it may be. So it all really depends on exactly when that's happening, how often it's happening, and what are the direct symptoms of it.
Yeah, I think the when it's happening is what's kind of resonating with us, right? Because, you know, he'll come home from school, right? And he'll be in our own house and he's talking, you know, it's like loudly and everything's fine. But when he's, you know, under some sort of anxiety or, you know, some sort of stress, or he's doing something that maybe he doesn't feel comfortable doing, that's when kind of the words have to be muffled or
you know, on the field.
Yeah. You know, and I'll give you an example. You know, one of the things that that he does with his mentor, which we can get into in a little bit, but they will literally do like an actual, you know, speed and agility workout, right? And they'll do the workout. He could do that with maybe some older peers of his, and he seems to be comfortable in that setting. But then at the end of the workouts, it's always a handshake and a thank you to everybody that he worked out with, and then his coach, you know, thank you, coach, right? And so that is viewed as like a respect, I guess, kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like in that scenario, he will kind of get like quiet. You know, it's not like a thanks, coach, like firmly, you know, directly, loudly. It's like, you know, it's like a mumbled, you know, a mumbled. And I'm curious, like, I don't understand why, because he's like, he just did this great thing. Like, he's proud of himself. I'm proud of him. Our coaches are proud of him. And it's like, he still is not almost like proud of himself. You know what I mean?
Well, you said he's 9.
Yeah, I mean, he's 9, right? But yeah.
So, you know, the whole concept of he just did this great thing, everyone's so proud of him, that's from the adult's perspective. You know, to him, it's, I just worked out, I'm around these big people who are bigger, stronger, faster, I'm being pushed, all these different things. You know, the whole idea of having to shake someone's hand and show that level of respect, maybe, you know, that's very arbitrary to a child. That's not, you know, that doesn't make the most sense. He probably feels like he's being forced to do it, and it's a little awkward, and it's a little strange, and it's a little uncomfortable. You know, he's good at running around, he's good at playing the sport, but then having to shake someone's hand and say thank you. He does it. He's doing it. He's not putting up a whole stink to keep himself from doing it and avoid it. He's doing it. He's just not showing our idea of an adult, our idea of how you should be saying thank you loud enough in the eye, those kinds of things. But in his mind, he probably thinks he's doing it just fine. He probably doesn't see any errors in why he's doing it. I think if we kind of just let it be and don't bring too much attention to it, I think over time, as he develops relationships and gets in the habit of doing it, you're going to see him start to do it like everyone else is doing it. But I don't see that as disrespect. I don't see that as a skill deficit. I see that as him being 9 and kind of thinking it's weird to have to do that.
Yep. I agree. Yeah. No, I agree. Go ahead, Beth.
I wanted to actually ask about your kind of switch gears a bit and talk about your calm parenting perspective. I know you talk about that a lot, and you know, kind of differentiate that between the permissive parenting, and that's not the right approach to take either. We don't want our kids to walk all over us. And I think a lot of parents want to take that approach because they want to avoid conflict at all costs. but I think that's also, you know, bit us in the butt, right? A lot of parents. So on your podcast, you talk about balancing the authoritative with the authoritarian approach. And I want you to help differentiate the two, because I feel like there's a fine line with speaking up and being super strict with your kids and holding your, you know, following through with what you're saying and being almost like verbally abusive or super loud and raising your voice. And where is the line drawn, and how can parents kind of tie that into sports and not acting like a freak on the sideline or like an animal?
And then also the second piece is like coaches, the same thing, right? How coaches voices and their you know, whole tone and all that as well.
Authoritarian style.
Sure. Yeah. So we don't want any authoritarian. There's no balance with authoritarian. We don't want any authoritarian, and we don't want any permissiveness. So basically we have seen an incredible rise in permissive parenting since the rise of screens, and screens have become a huge part of childhood. So ADHD in and of itself, ADHD kids are quite possibly the biggest victims of big tech's predatory marketing. They struggle socially, like you say. So parents say to themselves, oh, you know, he's really struggling socially. Let me get him Fortnite, Roblox, Minecraft, Snapchat, a phone, and that will help him. And it ends up completely making, you know, really delaying the skills even more and making him more antisocial. So since the rise of screens, so many parents, it's made parenting so incredibly hard because it dysregulates the kids, keeps them indoors, eliminates experiences, eliminates play, and makes parenting exponentially harder and makes the child have more and more outbursts over the screens. So the parents end up unintentionally falling into permissive practices. The definition of permissive parenting is when you overindulge the child to avoid conflict. And the ADHD brain, in like the impulsive instant gratification, time-blind brain, is constantly seeking dopamine. It's not looking to do things that require delayed gratification. It's constantly looking for instant gratification. And that means it's constantly seeking screens. Mm-hmm. And if screens are not available to them, they're going to seek conflict. And who sees the most conflict? The unconditional relationship of parents, or very close relationships like coaches and, you know, peers and things like that. So they're going to constantly seek those screens, which are going to dysregulate them even more. And then they're going to look for conflict to get that instant rush of dopamine. So it's really the authoritative parenting style that literally has close to 100 years of research that shows the benefits. But people confuse authoritative with authoritarian because it sounds way too similar. Authoritarian is that drill sergeant parenting, which really isn't going to help anything. It's going to, you know, create a lot of stress and could harm the relationship, all those kinds of things. We're looking for authoritative, where it's democratic, reciprocal, 50-50, clear rules, clear expectations, and a very clear hierarchy between the parent and the child. I am the parent. What I say goes, because I said so. I know what's best for you. I'm going to give you directives. You're not going to have a choice, but I'm not pushing you into hard labor or hard things. I'm going to ask you to do fun clubs, sports, activities, things that enrich your life, because I have better future thinking skills than you do. And I'm going to guide you through life with love, care, and respect into things you don't want to do at first, but eventually you're going to be happy I pushed you to do it. So that's really authoritative parenting is, you know, too many parents today have come down to the level of their child where they're trying to be their child's friend or their best friend, or, you know, my child is my co-parent kind of thing. And they often unintentionally fall into those practices. That's a problem, especially if they have ADHD. That's really going to throw off their reciprocity and their self-regulation. And it's going to cause a lot of problems. And you're going to get stuck in a vicious cycle of arguing, fighting, negotiating back and forth every single day. What we really need is a very clear hierarchy with very clear standards where parents keep the bar high.
Yeah, we have certainly cross the line of negotiating, I think, giving our kids too many choices.
Master negotiator.
That's exactly it.
And we've done it just to avoid that conflict, or maybe because we're worn out and we're drained and we want to just kind of relax and sit on the couch for an afternoon and, hey, yeah, go upstairs and play, you know, play
it's
Roblox.
A Band-Aid. It's like, go on the screen, go, you can have whatever you want, but in the long term, you see the effects or not.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, basically 1 hour of Fortnite on a Sunday is going to make them more attentive on Thursday, Friday, you know, in class. Parents think it's immediate, where it's going to be immediate dysregulation, but it's so dysregulating to the brain, you'll see the effects days later in school.
Yeah.
So as this, I heard this on one of your episodes as well, like I think you just had said it as well, but taking the option away, like this is what you're doing. That is interesting to me, because that was like that's a different way of thinking for me, because I struggle with that personally.
I feel like ask them questions. Hey, do you want to go get a shower? Hey, do you want? Yeah. And I said, no, you're going to get a shower, right? And this is what it is. Right. But I guess like the question is like, if you tell your child, hey, it's time to go get ready for your game, right? And they say, you know, 10 minutes. Do you think warnings help, or are they kind of just irrelevant? And what do you do if they don't? And obviously this stems with, you got to build those patterns and those habits, but what would you say to parents where their kids are just not immediately?
Or the struggles with the transitions, right? That's like it's like, hey, how do you warn them for the transition that's about to happen proactively, so it's not so reactive?
Let's go. Yeah. Let's get in the car. The game's in 20 minutes.
Yeah. So the most important thing for ADHD parents to understand is that verbal prompts don't help. So language makes dysregulation worse. So the more you verbally give them warnings, verbally tell them things. Remember, this is not attention deficit disorder. It's negative attention stimulation disorder. So they get stimulation and dopamine from your prompts, from the warnings, from all those things, because that makes them feel like they're in complete control and they have you in the palm of their hands. So the more you're following them around in the morning. You know, ADHD parents get stuck in the mindset of every single day they operate under this thought: nothing gets done unless I step in. And that ends up creating a massive mess where parents unintentionally become permissive helicopter parents, where they're constantly pushing their kid, prompting them, acting as their executive functioning. And it creates a whole year-long problem of issues where the kids are in complete control with their behaviors. So ADHD kids, what parents have to understand is this is a very high IQ, but low executive functioning. And the only way to experience executive function is the only way to strengthen executive function is through experiences. So you don't have to constantly remind them and give them warnings. They know. They know they have to be out the door. They heard you the first time. Say it once and that's it. And if they're late to practice, they need to go explain to the coach why they were uncomfortable, why they were late. And they need to feel that uncomfortable feeling of having to go explain to the coach, even if he says it low or says it like in a unintelligible way.
And he doesn't like being late, so that could be a good
one. So there you have it. So he has to experience that feeling of being late and have it be his fault. And I don't like the way that feels, being late. So next time he's able to move, so he doesn't have to experience that emotion again. But if you as the parents keep saving him and stimulating him with negative attention, with warning after warning after warning, then you're making it too stimulating to be late, too dilly-dally,
so
to create problems.
Be a clear consequence. You say it once, they don't listen.
Say it once, wait in the car.
Or we're just brushing your teeth or getting ready for bed. If you don't do it, there's going to be some type of...
Correct. He's 9 years old now. He obviously, you know, is a major athlete and is very motivated by those things. So you say it once and you literally wait in the car for him and you do nothing.
Is there associated with a consequence if it doesn't happen or it doesn't act like what's the right way to look at that, right? Is it a consequence that the parent would give them, or is it just...
The consequence is having to talk to the coach and say why you were late. That's the consequence.
Okay.
That's it. That's the only consequence that's needed. You don't have to ground him or do this or do that. It's the experience.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what if a parent's listening, they say, my kids don't care if they're late.
That's complete nonsense. That's you falling for their emotional manipulation. So they might say, I don't care. Like this is what ADHD kids are masters at. I don't care if you give me, I don't care if I get detention. I don't care if I get an F. I don't care if I do this. That's just them trying to upset you more and create that 3 hour, 5 hour argument vortex. So if they truly don't care that they're late, then okay, go tell the coach and explain why you were late. Go ahead and go do it and show me you don't care. Go do it very nonchalantly. They're going to care. They're not going to want to do that. And if you need to continue to eliminate, you know, obviously if you're dealing with these kind of behaviors, there's zero reason for your kids to have a smartphone, an Xbox, a PlayStation, internet, YouTube time, any of those things anyway. So those things should be removed in the first place. But if you do still have those things in your home, which you obviously shouldn't based on mountains of research, if you still have those things in your home and you're seeing those behaviors, you should eliminate them immediately.
Yeah, I totally agree. Can we switch now? I think one of the most resonating thing that we've shared with parents and heard from parents that we work with is their kids not able to regulate their emotions when they make a mistake on the field or if they're losing. And this is what also we've experienced with our son over the last few years, and it's gotten much better for sure, but we still see it come out every now and then. The losing and the making mistakes, the failure, the crying, the not wanting to continue playing. How can parents teach their kids without being super, you know, helicoptery or authoritarian style, get them to regulate emotions on the field? Because you can't run on the field, right? You can't say, calm down, breathe. It's something that doesn't help sometimes, right? So what do you suggest?
So we have to remember, this is negative attention stimulation disorder. And parents often unintentionally step in and unintentionally reinforce those behaviors. So when they're having a meltdown on the field, they might get sent off the field. And then parents instantly want to go over and self-sue them. Because let's be honest, let's look at it from the parents' perspective. It could be a little embarrassing. My kid's not handling this as well as everybody else. And my kid, those kinds of things. But, you know, really what you need to do is allow the child to sit, because when you go over there and you give them attention and help to self-soothe them, you're unintentionally reinforcing that behavior by bringing attention to it. Anything you bring attention to with ADHD grows. So all ADHD behaviors need an audience. Like, there's the old saying of if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around to hear it, does it make a sound? If mom and dad aren't there, is there an ADHD behavior? You know, it's those kinds of things. So you need to make it very, very clear to the coaches. My child has ADHD. My child has delayed emotional regulation skills. The second you see them start to show a sign of decreased sportsmanship or getting upset over losing or losing their cool, they need to be immediately sent off the field, period. I don't care if they're the star of the team or whatever it may be. They need to be sent off to take a brain break. Sit down, watch, and they can come back when they are ready. It needs to be very clear. Let's say the athlete's name is Mike. That person needs to build a self-awareness around ready Mike and not ready Mike. When ready Mike is present and adults see that is ready Mike, you can be on the field. You can be with your teammates. You can participate in that privilege. When you are not ready Mike, you need to be sitting on the bench quietly, maybe even some noise-canceling headphones, whatever it may be, not talking to anybody. Parents don't come over and self-soothe. Coach doesn't come over and self-soothe. You sit down and you cannot re-enter the game until one of the coaches determines they see ready Mike is back. So it's all about that self-awareness piece, but they need a brain break by themselves with no attention brought to it.
What about the people that would say, and maybe it's the sport, right? Maybe it's just the specific sport, but the people that say that emotion, like, it's okay to have emotion, right? If something doesn't go your way, you can get pissed off. You can show some sort of frustration, but you have to keep going. You can't shut down. You have to, you know, so there's like a fine line there. It's like, okay,
is it preventing him from helping us?
Right. Like one of the things, so just an example that like we've personally used, I guess in like the football world is, okay, if you miss a tackle, like what happens with us, just to be very transparent, is if there's failure, meaning he missed a tackle or he dropped a pass or something didn't go his way or a kid beat him for a touchdown, what will often happen is he'll somehow like go down and almost like fake an injury and like cry and like get mad. But it's like, you know, he's pounding the ground or he's like holding his foot because it's almost like internally he's kind of like making an excuse.
Yeah. Correct.
But, but at the same time, it could be a scenario where it's, hey, you know, we can say get on to the next play, like on to the next play, you know, like that's the way to think. Now he's sort of like, he's very emotional and mentally he's not in a good place for however long, a minute, whatever it may be, but he's able to sort of like keep going. And then once that next play happens or next scenario takes place, the emotion goes away. Right. So there's like that aspect where like, I can see from a coach's perspective, like emotion's okay, just keep going. Or then the other one, like you're saying, where, hey, he's shut down. We want to like teach a lesson here that you can't, fake an injury if something doesn't go your way. So we're going to take you out of the game and basically let you think about what you did wrong.
I think you have to be on the same page with the coach too. And I think a lot of parents don't talk to the coach before the season and say, hey, this is our plan. Can you please be on board with this? If you see this, make sure you do this, right?
Well, this is sort of like also coming into the concept of taking accountability,
which is very hard for
him. Which is hard for him. Obviously he's young, but like, I don't know, over, I'm curious to get your perspective over the years, how that develops, but like being able to say, hey, yeah, my bad, you know, my mistake, or, you know, get better next, like those types of things. Like that's really one of the aspects too, that just seems so far away.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. He's nowhere near that developmentally yet. So don't even waste your time trying to get him to admit what he's doing. You know, these ADHD kids are so incredibly smart. They know what they're doing, but their executive functioning level. So that's a big thing that ADHD parents get stuck on, is the kid will lie, or they'll miss an assignment or do something at school or whatever. And immediately the parents like, admit what you did, say you're sorry, go and apologize, go do this right now. And the ADHD kid they're just not developmentally ready to do that yet. But when you take a step back and a bird's eye view, this takes us back to that point I made earlier, where that's the adult mind. In the adult mind, if they admit what they did, then they'll stop doing it. If they go and apologize, then they'll stop doing it. But if anything, you're just bringing more and more attention to it and giving them more and more power and those kinds of things. So that's an adult concept of accountability and understanding, not for a kid. So don't ever waste your time trying to get them to say, yeah, I faked an injury. Yeah, I got too mad. Like that, there's no point in getting them to verbally admit it. That's not what's going to build the skill to change the behavior. That's just going to make you feel better as a parent. Oh, I got him to admit it. It's not going to build an internal skill. So mom made a great point. You have to really have a relationship with the coach. If you're seeing a pattern of behavior, it's normal for all 9, 10, 11 year olds to fake an injury, get upset, have some bad unsportsmanship, those kinds of things, because it's competitive. It's hard. But when you see it become a pattern of behavior where every time you get beat for a touchdown, every time this happens, it's the immediate impulse of action to let me fake an injury. And that's why the guy got past me. That's why that happened. It's not my level of play. It's because I was hurt. So it needs to be very clear where, hey, if you get hurt, you need to make your way to the sideline. You need to be on the sideline. No one's going to come by and help you and check on you and those kinds of things. You need to make your way to the sideline, take a seat, and I'll allow you to re-enter the game when I see you are ready. And that's what I have in my workbook. The Playbook in Action is a whole self-awareness section that helps the kid understand what ready Mike and not ready Mike looks like. And that sounds like what would be the most beneficial thing for your son, is for him to recognize, hey, I'm ready right now. I can be around people. I can interact with people. I'm not ready right now, which is okay. But when I'm not ready, I should expect zero attention from other people. I should expect zero audience. I should expect zero language directed my way, because when a child is not ready, language makes dysregulation worse. And if you check in on him to make him feel better, or to self-soothe, or to, you know, make sure his injury is okay, you're going to reinforce that behavior. When you identify him as ready again, then you can help him.
So, okay, first of all, I did get your book from Amazon. So we
will. Oh, nice. Thank you.
We're working on that for sure. We have a lot of other things that we work on with him. We have a growth tracker where to build the awareness piece, where he fills it out every week and they have a goal that they have to achieve in the mindset, character, and habits category to build that. And, you know, after their games, he goes and he says, okay, well, how was I, you know, at practice the other day? Was I a good leader? Was I resilient? Did I prep in advance all of my stuff so I wasn't rushing out the door and creating anxiety, stuff like that? So I do think that doing that stuff before the game and proactively is super important for parents to do, and the kids, so that it's not like you're throwing them out there and expecting them to know how to, you know, what a ready Cal or ready Mike is, right?
It sounds like he would do very well with the video journals that I talk about in the workbook, where he can use basically like any computer or any phone with a front-facing camera and talk into it,
recording himself.
So yeah, record a video of himself stating his goals for the game, what he wants to accomplish, who he wants to be, all those kinds of things. Then after the game, have him watch that video he recorded, then record a second response video. So he's completing like a he's creating like a video portfolio, like a professional development, growth development portfolio of all these tracker videos, where it's not mom and dad telling him what to say or telling goals for him. It's his voice, his face, his mannerisms talking into the camera himself. And that's very powerful for kids.
I love that. Yeah. I think, do you think also teaching them, you said you don't want to, you can't force them to feel that, not responsibility, the
accountability.
Accountability. You can't force that on them. So what is your recommendation for doing that if they are constantly like, oh, we lost because, you know, that player didn't do this, or we lost because, like, do you, should
or
you
Or the coach's fault or something. It's always
the stuff that they are doing well when you do catch, oh, wow, good job not, or good job doing this. And is that the best way to kind of teach that, or do you just let it go? And
so you have to, remember these ADHD kids are very, very smart, and they have a conflict-seeking brain. So the only reason they're blaming the coach or blaming other people behind closed doors when it's just mom and dad around is to pull you in and to get you to say, no, no, this didn't happen, to create a 5, 10, 15, 20-hour-long argument over nonsense. So the only way to eliminate that behavior and to teach him true accountability is to bring absolutely zero attention to it. Okay. So when he starts blaming others, you can literally say nothing, or you can just be like, okay, just be like, just let him say it, because deep down he knows, like, he knows it's not the coach's fault. He knows these things, you know. ADHD is not a disorder of intelligence, it's a disorder of performance, and in that real time. So he knows all these things. He's just saying it to gain control of the situation, to pull you in and to get you to say that's not true, this, that, whatever. So anytime you think you're teaching him something, you're just feeding into that behavior by bringing attention to it.
Sure.
What about the concept of, go ahead, Lex, you have something?
You want to talk about the after the game? I wanted to mention that.
Well, I had a question about the concept of positive praise, you know, and how receptive he is to that, because I feel like there's often times where he has a very like pessimistic view of just the day, like, quite frankly. And, you know, we try to build him up as best we can and try anything we can to positively praise him for. But like, it seems to work in like small spurts, right? Mm-hmm. And then it kind of like, you know, it doesn't really have its, it loses its luster. Like, I don't know. You guys are just talking, and I just thought about that, because whether it's on the playing field or from a coach's perspective, or whether it's the car ride home, we want to find like that smallest thing we can praise him for. Like how receptive he is to those things vary.
I think he hears it, but he doesn't show the emotion like, oh, I'm super proud that my parents, he kind of is like, yeah, okay, yeah, whatever. Right.
Right. Right.
Of course. And that's all part of that defense mechanism and constant drive for control. So, you know, when it's just like it's his impulsive instinct when someone beats him for a touchdown to fall down and fake an injury. It's his impulsive instinct when I get positive praise to flip on it and gain control of that situation. That's the exact same thought process where he's doing that. So the biggest thing that parents of athletes need to be very, very careful of is that drive home from the game. There's an incredibly high percentage of kids that quit the sport on the ride home from the game. So that is when emotions are the highest. That's when they're going to seek control the highest. On that ride home, you might want to put on a podcast, you might want to put on music, and have zero conversation whatsoever. Don't try to provide, don't give any praise on that ride home. Don't ask him what he was thinking. Don't talk about the game at all, because he will try to flip it and make it super negative, super pessimistic, to make sure that entire ride home, he's in control with his negativity. ADHD kids are masters at controlling things with their parents through complaining, through negativity, through negative self-talk. So be very, very careful with that car ride home. When it comes go ahead.
No, I was like, well, it's like any sort of constructive dialogue that we try to have, it's taken as criticism.
No, but I think he said, well, I think the big part is that their emotions are super high after the game, right? Especially if they lose.
He's not ready for any conversation. He's showing you.
So there's
the old saying, all behavior is communication. But social media teaches us teaches us that that only applies when it's warm and fuzzy and makes us feel good. Like, oh, that's just a connection seeking behavior. He just needs more hugs and kisses and me to get on his level. But in reality, right then he's teaching you, I'm not ready for any attention right now. So mm-hmm. if he's just flipping everything with negativity, he's showing you my brain is so dysregulated right now. I'm mm-hmm. so off the high of the game, the competition of the game. Everything you're saying to me is just making me feel worse. So he's showing you with his behaviors, I can't handle language and attention right now. So anytime you see that, end the conversation immediately. If you're in the car, put on a podcast, put on a song, and just drive to the music. And, you know, language is going to make things worse. Just like earlier, I made the connection between ADHD and speech and language. It's that exact same thing. Their brain gets so dysregulated, so fried. You know, it's basically the RAM of the computer of the brain just hits overdrive and gets too filled, where like, you know, like the mail, like the trash bin in the computer is too filled. That's basically what it is. He just went through a whole competitive game where everyone was watching him, where it's very black and white, win or lose, whatever it may be. And he's going to be attention seeking. He's going to want to flip that negativity. You're going to want to remove all language completely.
Mm-hmm. What about on the way through the game? Because on the way to the game, he, you know, he's often very quiet.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's so fantastic.
I try to just play music then too. And I don't really talk to him much.
Yeah.
Don't put any expectations on it. Play the music. And if he's being quiet, we should respect that. And that's him probably self-regulating. Maybe his mind is thinking about whatever a 9-year-old boy thinks about. Maybe he's trying to visualize the game and prepare for the game, but you know, respect that peace, respect that quiet. Don't try to make him talk if he's self-regulating through quietness. As long as he doesn't have an iPad in front of him or a phone in front of him or anything like that to dysregulate him, and he's just staring out the window being quiet, that's fantastic.
As his dad, I sometimes think I've made the mistakes personally of kind of translating that as he doesn't really want to be going, or he's scared to go. He's just not into whatever we're going to do.
Even if that's the case, you know, he loves it and that you're going
to. Yeah. And so I like, then I get into the whole like, ooh, should I be pushing him to do this or should not? Or, you know, it kind of plays a mental game with me then too. But anyway.
No. So, you know, if he's getting nervous, that's completely normal. So like I can say for myself, I'm 39 years old and I go and I do lots of professional development. I do presentations and I do huge keynote speaking and things like that. I've done it probably close to 400, 500 times now, and I still get nervous. Mm-hmm. And I always show up early to set up all the tech and the projector and things like that. And they're always offering me all these food and all this stuff. And sometimes I really want to eat the food, but I'm so nervous I can't eat. I'm always like, sorry, I can't eat before my presentations. I can't do that. And that's probably exactly how he's feeling. He's being quiet because he's nervous. And I'm sure LeBron James still gets nervous. I'm still, you know, Patrick Mahomes still gets nervous. It's all part of it. You know, like there's NFL players that throw up before every game still. Like I think Josh Allen does that. So, you know, just in, like that is completely normal. He's, you know, all nervousness is, and you can teach him this. All nervousness is the body telling you you're about to do something different, something important. You know what I mean? If he played in a sports game 3 times a day, every single day for a year, then yeah, he'd probably get a little numb to it. But because he's doing it, you know, sparingly here and there, and it's so huge, so competitive, so stimulating, then yeah, he has to build up his body towards it. And he's doing it through behaviors or silence.
I'm glad that you agree with us that the car ride home is super important and to shut your mouth. Because I know growing up playing sports, I have bad memories, you know, you dread getting in the car, which is super sad. Right. But it's it's that traditional parenting where you just hash it out all in the car and you just let your kids have it. And you tell them all the things that you're thinking of during the game. Why don't you do this? But I think we all agree now that that's never going to help them, right? They're not, if anything, they're not going to be excited. They're not going to love the game anymore. And they're not going to listen to you. You think they're going to listen? It's not going to happen, right? So I think I'm glad we're on the same page with that. Now, let me ask you this. This is what we have been doing with our son is we don't say anything after the game, right? And we go home and later on, once he's chilled out and calmed down, maybe a couple hours later at night, we talk to him at night. He's so open to talking at night because he never wants to sleep, right? He's so when he's in bed, he's like, oh, anything else to stay awake? And I use that to my advantage. We both do to talk to him and say, hey, so about the game earlier, you know, do you want to talk about anything? Is there anything that you think you could have done differently? Do you think that is a good approach? And if there, are there any questions that you think we should ask our players, you know, our athletes to kind of get them to kind of reflect a bit or think about, you know, how
well, I guess, next time? Yeah. Well, I guess the main question there is it working? Is he getting dysregulated at nighttime and then, and extending it and him not falling asleep much later? Or no. Is he having a productive conversation?
No, because he knows if it's not productive, I'm leaving.
There you go. So it's working. So don't second guess yourself. It's working. He's following through. You might, if you guys end up following through on this video journal thing, maybe it starts with that. Maybe he records a video before the game, after the game at some point, maybe before bed, maybe it becomes part of his bedtime routine of, you know, brushing teeth, shower, whatever, do your video journal, do your response. And then maybe you sit with him on the bed, watch the video he recorded, watch the second video, the response video, watch it with him, and then have a conversation about that video.
Love that. Definitely going to try that.
Yeah. But if it's working, don't second guess yourself. It's, you know, ADHD parents second guess themselves, 100 times more than neurotypical parents. just like what Dad was saying before of, am I pushing him too much? Am I this? Yeah. Am I that? And that's all common. But, you know, the fact that you guys have an ADHD child who's into sports and you guys are focused on outdoor play and teamwork and those kinds of things, you're already doing so much more right than wrong. And he's 9 years old. He's still a baby. He's still so incredibly young. You guys giving him these experiences now are setting him up for so much future success, not only on the field, but also in the workplace, also in his future social relationships. You know, him, you know, these experiences as a kid are molding his brain. There's nothing more important for the ADHD brain than outdoor play, exercise, movement, teamwork, competition, all these kinds of things. You know, that's why another reason why screens are so horrible for ADHD kids, because it keeps them sedentary, keeps them inside, and keeps them dormant and antisocial. Mm-hmm. You guys have taken the steps to turn him into an athlete, get him constant exercise, get him constant movement. And that is just really building his brain in the way that like medication does, in the way that, you know, all the overall work does. So these sports you're giving him is like the best possible therapy in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. We still have a little bit too much SpongeBob on our TV when they come home from school, but
hey, TV's okay. TV's okay. As long as it's not YouTube on the TV, TV's okay.
No YouTube.
You guys need a break too. You guys need to, you know, cook and clean and be adults and have your own lives. So have no guilt over cable TV.
Okay. Do you have any other questions there? Because I have one like ending question.
No, please. I mean, this has been great. Yeah, I mean, helpful. Fleck, please feel free. Yeah.
So obviously giving our listeners something to physically do, not physically, but to take away and put into action immediately would be super helpful. Is there like one or two things that you can tell the parents or coaches listening that they could apply, you know, maybe today or this weekend when it comes to practices or games to help their children emotionally regulate better?
Sure. So, you know, really, kids learn emotional regulation through experiences and best with conditional relationships in their lives. So one of the best advices for ADHD parents is you have to keep home and school separate. So like so many ADHD parents take off their parenting hat and put on the homework secretary hat. And they have to sit with the kid while they're doing their homework and show me what you have, show me what you turned it in. And it turns 10 minutes of homework into a 3-hour fight. And then the only way to really fix that situation is for them to start doing their homework at school, at a local library, with a peer, with a college student, with somebody who's not mom and dad, someone who is a conditional relationship. Then you're going to see the progress. Then you're going to see the skill building. Because to the ADHD brain, why do my homework? Why do this incredibly boring, difficult work when mom and dad are right there and I can get into a fight with them and it's not going to affect the relationship because it's an unconditional relationship? It should be the exact same thing with sports. You know, don't find yourself being like coach number one, coach number two, or coach number three. Don't try to be a co-coach. Don't try to be an assistant coach. You're still the parent. They're always going to see you as the parent. They're never going to see you as a coach. So if any way you can communicate with that coach and have those conversations and build that relationship and, you know, find different ways for that coach to spend some one-on-one time with your child before games, after games, at practice, just talking about things. So just like we need to keep home and school separate, keep home and the sports separate, so you're not overstepping your boundaries as a parent, and it's the coach holding the child accountable, not you.
Yeah, I like that, keeping it separate. But again, it needs to be communicated to the coach, and you need 100%. To actually vibe with the coach, right? If you guys have different values and you don't like the coach, then, I mean, it may be
difficult
to do that.
And if you happen to have hired a parent coach or a parent trainer, which is the number one recommendation, not talk therapy, not counseling. If you happen to have a parent trainer, have that parent trainer have a 5-10 minute conversation with the coach, like teach them about the whole ready, not ready, teach them about the brain breaks. It's very simple stuff. It's not like you don't need a degree to understand it. It's just very simple, instant consequences of, they're dysregulated on the field. Let them take a brain break. Let them take a pause. Let them understand ready versus not ready. And you can see some pretty rapid progress when it's not mom and dad doing it.
Love that.
Absolutely. Mike, thank you so much for joining. This has been an incredible conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you guys. You guys are doing incredible work. This is such valuable information. So, keep doing what you're doing. Doing a podcast is not easy. All the work that goes on behind the scenes, but this is really, really cool. You guys are doing this.
Thanks. We will. We really just want to help a lot of people out. That's why we're doing it. So.
And that's exactly what you're going to do.
Yep. All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.